This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. President Trump will address the United Nations General Assembly Tuesday, and a senior official said he will affirm America's leadership. On Monday, Trump met with French President Emmanuel Macron, who is apparently attempting to ease the tensions between the U.S. and Iran. VOA's senior White House correspondent Steve Herman has more.
Trump appears to be rebuffing Macron's efforts with Iran.
We're not looking for any mediators. They know who to call.
In a joint statement, Britain, France, and Germany are holding Iran responsible for recent attacks on Saudi oil installations, which has prompted concerns about the possibility of war between the West and the Islamic Republic. Trump says he'll be talking about Iran's aggression in his address Tuesday to the UN General Assembly. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the United Nations.
Three powerful leaders of the U.S. Congress are demanding Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to start turning over all documents related to the Trump-Ukraine telephone call by Thursday or face subpoenas. President Trump confirming that he raised the subject of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son in the July phone call with Ukraine's president. Trump is facing allegations that he pressured Ukraine to investigate his potential 2020 rival, which he denies. Monday, Trump described the content of the call.
Was largely corruption, all of the corruption taking place. Was largely the fact that we don't want our people, like Vice President Biden and his son, creating to the corruption already in the Ukraine.
But his admission about the phone call is fueling calls for Democrats to launch impeachment proceedings in Congress. For more news, we, as always, we'd like to invite you to join us. VOAnews.com or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The Trump administration is doing away with the so-called catch-and-release policy for Central American immigrants, who legally cross into the United States. Under catch and release, Border Patrol agents who catch illegal migrants temporarily detain them until they are assigned a court date for an immigration hearing and then release them. The acting Homeland Security Secretary said, except for some humanitarian and medical exceptions, immigrants who cannot successfully claim their lives would be in danger would be sent back to their home countries. Those who can prove a genuine fear would be returned to Mexico while their asylum requests are processed. Several hundred thousand people are stranded at airports around the world, including hundreds of travelers at the Orlando International Airport in Florida here in the U.S., after the British travel company Thomas Cook abruptly shut down without warning.
So, yeah, we're a bit disappointed that this has happened, yeah.
And then when we woke up this morning, we got texts from our friends and family saying, oh, my God, how are you getting home? Started to panic and get a bit worried, so that's why we rushed to the airport.
Yeah, it wasn't nice. It wasn't a nice feeling. You just want, by the time you get to the end of your holiday, you just want to get home. You just want to be in your own bed and, you know, you've got work and things to think about.
Thomas Cook's British customers are assured flights home because of the British government's state-run travel insurance. Thomas Cook ceased operations after the British government failed to approve a bailout and its creditors and investors rejected a $250 million emergency fund. Thomas Cook also blamed his problems on several factors, including the emergence of budget airlines. The United Auto Workers strike against General Motors here in the U.S. is in its second week. AP auto writer Tom Kreischer reports there has been some progress, but no end in sight.
They're hung up over wages and profit sharing, temporary workers, the use of them, and trying to get them a path to being full-time workers. They're also haggling over what to put in plants that GM wants to close. There are four of them, and they're trying to figure out that.
AP's Tom Kreischer. The families of 350 make that 46 people killed in two Boeing 737 MAX crashes will each receive nearly $145,000 from the airline company. Boeing set up a $50 million fund to compensate families of those who died in the crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. The fund began taking applications for compensation Monday and will continue through December the 31st. The 737 MAX remains grounded. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Fears rise among Nigerians amid recent wave of abductions.
There's hunger in the land, and Nigeria has been on economy doldrum for some years now, and crime will increase because people will become more desperate.
Nigeria's Attorney General says his country is seeking to claim millions of dollars from companies with offshore contracts. Malawi repatriates its citizens targeted in South Africa's xenophobic attacks. Zimbabwe's capital closes its water plant, and Liberian health workers go on a slowdown to demand salary arrears and better working conditions.
Our hospitals are empty. There are no medications, no laboratory equipment. So we want government to restock hospitals, to increase the health budget so that these supplies are available.
Using Camo mobile clinics to provide health services to remote areas of Kenya's Rift Valley region and suspected cholera cases in parts of Sudan. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A recent wave of abductions in Nigeria is raising fear across the country. Unlike kidnappings involving militants who agitate against oil companies in the south or the Islamic group Boko Haram in the north, which often take on political dimensions, this wave spans every region and is driven largely by economic hardship. As Timothy Obiozu reports from Abuja, the government says it is trying to address the problem.
32-year-old Olumide Peter was returning from an evening class at the International Institute of Journalism in Abuja when several men hijacked his car and took him away.
I tried to maneuver myself to open the door. They overpowered me. They hit me with a spanner and some vehicle tools. I mean, the guy came out with a gun. He said he was going to kill me.
The kidnappers held Olumide for days and tortured him until an unknown amount was paid to secure his freedom. Nigeria is seeing an unusual kidnapping wave that is cutting across every socio-economic class. According to the police, 685 kidnappings occurred nationwide in the first quarter of the year, an average of 7 per day. Kidnappers demand between $1,000 to $150,000 as ransom, depending on the financial resources of the victims. In the past, many abductions were traced to militants in the south agitating against oil companies or the Islamist militant group Boko Haram in the north. Security experts like Senator Iregu say the recent abductions are the result of Nigeria's economic hardships and poverty.
In fact, most of us saw it coming because there is hunger in the land, and Nigeria has been on economy doldrum for some years now, and crime will increase because people will become more desperate.
The Nigerian government responded to the wave of kidnappings by setting up an abduction response team. Police spokesperson Frank Mba says the team is making progress.
There's actually a decrease, a significant drop in the rate of kidnapping in Nigeria. And this drop began to manifest itself soon after the launching of Operation Pofada. A very effective and efficient anti-crime strategy.
But Iribu says the police force may be unprepared for the tasks ahead.
The number of our police force is not near to the United Nations standard, per 500 people or 1,000 people within a space. So we are short of manpower, we are short of intelligence, we are short of communal cooperation that we need.
A number of kidnappers captured across Nigeria were paraded publicly in Abuja last week. Many here believe if triggers like unemployment and poverty can be reduced, kidnappings will go down as well. While security officials continue to crack down on perpetrators, victims like Olumide move on with their lives, looking over their shoulders, aware that they could be abducted again. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigeria's attorney general says his country is on the brink of recovering what he calls colossal sums of money from oil companies with offshore contracts in Nigeria. Abubakar Malami says a 1990s law governing oil production companies sharing contracts allows the Nigerian government to review revenue sharing once the price of oil rises about $20 per barrel. Malami, who was in London on Monday, would not disclose the exact amount the government is seeking to claim, but industry and government sources told the Reuters news agency that Royal Dutch Shell, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Eni, Total and Equinor were each asked to pay the Nigerian government between $2.5 billion and $5 billion.
By virtue of the prevailing law relating to deep shore exploration, the law stated over a decade ago that when the threshold of the price of oil per barrel reaches $20, there should be a review of the profit sharing contract between the parties. And then such incidents have happened right from the onset, and there had not been existing review. So arising from that, it is the Nigerian position that Nigeria is entitled to make a claim arising from the inability to have the profit sharing contract reviewed over time. So the corporate judicial process has been initiated in that respect.
Exactly how much money are we talking about? Can you say which companies are involved?
It is not an amount I can tell you clearly of it, but indeed it has been computed and a case has been presented, and parties are naturally accorded an opportunity through judicial processes to either admit or deny liability and put in a counterclaim in case there is any.
The companies you're talking about, do they include Royal Dutch, Shell, Chevron, Exxon, Mobil, Total, and Equinor? And is it true that some time ago, each of them were asked to pay the central government between $2.5 billion to $5 billion each?
Well, the amount is not a general blocked amount, but then it all depends on the computation of what has been lifted over time. And a lot of companies are indeed involved. I am not in a position to say clearly whether this company listed by you were all included, or some of them, or part of them are included. But a lot of oil majors are indeed involved.
You are in London. Can you tell us the reason for your being in London?
Well, the reason I'm in London has to do with gas processing agreement that was entered into between Nigeria and a company by name T&I. And there happens to be a claim of breach relating to the contract and an award, additional award. So that additional award that now stands at around $9 billion is being considered for enforcement. And then we are in UK for the purpose of ensuring at the end of the day, putting across a case for setting aside the award, which we believe was not liable to be set aside.
Abubakar Malami is Nigeria's Attorney General. He was speaking with us from London, the United Kingdom. Liberian health workers Monday staged a strike at public health facilities throughout the country. The National Health Workers Association is demanding a better working environment for health workers and payment of their salary arrears. Moses Gaziewu reports from Monrovia.
Healthcare services at public health facilities were paralyzed on Monday as public health workers began a go slow. Patients were turned away as the strike shut down public hospitals and clinics throughout the country. The health workers say they are not protected in the workplace and have no equipment to work with. George Paul Williams is Secretary General of the National Health Workers Association of Liberia.
Our hospitals are empty. There are no medications, no laboratory equipment, reagents to do labs for patients. And even there are no protective gears to protect the health workers and their patients. So we want government to restock hospitals, to increase the health budget so that these supplies are available.
Williams says health workers earn very little, and whatever little they are entitled to has not been regular from the government in recent 10 months.
We are talking in terms of salaries for the month of July, the month of August, and the month of September, because September is already ending. There are some health workers who have not taken pay for 8 months, 4 months, and you can just name it.
The health workers strike also anger pregnant women and mothers with young babies who were turned away at the government hospital in Pennsylvania. The women set up roadblocks and demanded treatment. They later removed the roadblocks following intervention by the Inspector General of Police, Patrick Sudu.
We came and passionately appealed to the women involved, and they saw reason and decided to take out the roadblocks. They said this morning they came for treatment. There were no nurse or doctor to attend to them.
Meanwhile, the Liberian government says it has begun paying salary arrears for the health workers for the month of July and August. Finance and Development Planning Minister Samuel Tua said the ongoing harmonization of government workers' earning is the result of delay in paying the health workers.
The government paid July's salary on a harmonized wage. There were some issues. People were left out of the payroll because all of the controllers didn't submit all of the names to the government. For example, health workers' grades were miscategorized, and so based on that, there were some errors in the process.
Minister Tue, who chairs the cabinet while President George Weah is attending the United Nations General Assembly in New York, appealed to the health workers to end their strike because government was doing all to settle their arrears.
We're appealing to all our hardworking nurses, our doctors, our medical practitioners all across the country to know that their government stands fully with them. We empathize with their challenges. We're working assiduously to ensure that they get their money on time.
But the health workers said they would not return to work until the government meets all their demands. National Health Workers Secretary General John Paul Williams told VOA there are other important issues beyond salary concerns.
These issues have not all been addressed. Not everybody has gotten text message that their salaries are ready. Even those who have received salaries, they have not gotten 100% of their salaries.
Currently, Liberia faces serious economic challenges and most of the population depends on public health facilities for health care. But if the health workers are right, it is not clear when the strike will end. For VOA News, this is Moses Gazio reporting from Monrovia, Liberia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 24. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. About 75 of the Malawians displaced by recent xenophobic attacks in South Africa have returned home. Malawi's government repatriated them last Thursday after spending weeks at a guarded camp in Johannesburg. Islamic Masina reports from Blantyre. Some of them say they will never go back to South Africa, while others are not so sure.
Gladys Majawa left in Katabe district in northern Malawi 5 years ago in South Africa's commercial capital, Johannesburg. She says, I left for South Africa alone because of poverty at home. Some of my friends had an opportunity to raise money to build houses. That's why I also decided to seek a fortune there. But attacks on foreign nationals in Johannesburg early this month forced Majawa to cut short her plans to stay in South Africa until next year. Recent violence left 12 people dead and shops looted. Majawa's family scattered in the mayhem. She says, I even don't know where the father of my children is because each one of us was running in different directions. I only cared about my children and my life. I picked my 3 children and ran for safety. Majawa had been working as a housemaid. Now she says she has no plans to go back to South Africa. She says, I don't like the place anymore. I had a bitter experience. I have lost interest. There are very cruel people in South Africa. The World Bank says more than half of Malawi's population lives below the poverty line, and about a quarter of them survive on less than $2 a day. For many, migrating to South Africa as a domestic laborer is their only option to escape poverty. That fact appears to have prompted some Malawians to remain in South Africa despite threats to their safety. Wilson Mollen is a commissioner for disasters.
The ones that were displaced were 113, and the people that have turned up here are only 76, and the rest have gone back to their communities because this was voluntary repatriation.
Back home, some victims like Winnie Umari are undecided on whether they will go back to South Africa one day. He says, I can't say for certain that I will return or not. I'm still energetic right now. What I can say is that it will take 2 or 3 years before I make a decision. The Malawi Red Cross Society, which provided temporary shelters for the repatriated victims, says it will continue to assist them as they reintegrate into Malawian society. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Zimbabwe's capital has closed its water plant due to lack of funds to purchase water treatment chemicals. The closures will force residents to rely on open and untreated water sources. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
38-year-old Grace Kufakunesu, a mother of three, says for months now she has been relying on open water sources for her household chores. The city of Harare blames erratic water supplies on the drought. Authorities have never informed us about what is causing those water cuts, she says. We just see our taps without water. We go to the streams to fetch water for bathing. Sometimes you end up using it for cooking since you won't be having any clean water. Bowls are few, plus there are long queues. So the little clean water we have, we use it for drinking. The tap water we have, sometimes you fill it in a container, you can see dirty stuff, so people are always complaining of stomach bugs, she says. Michael Chideme, city of Harare spokesman, confirmed to VOA that Zimbabwe's capital had stopped purifying water because it was struggling to import water treatment chemicals.
What happens is, on our side, our budget for water is now exhausted. We have approached government to appraise government of the need to support the water sector through declaring it an emergency so that funding partners can also come on board and assist the city in the long-term projects.
For years now, rights groups have accused the government of patronizing matters such as foreign trips and luxury vehicles for senior officials, neglecting issues like health care, education, and water supplies. In 2008, lack of water treatment chemicals resulted in about 5,000 deaths from cholera. It was only after the intervention of the UN Agency for International Development and the European Union that the disease was contained. Now, with the water plant closed in Harare, residents of the capital fear that that might happen again. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
Health workers with the African Medical and Research Foundation are using camel mobile clinics to provide health services to locals in the remote areas of Kenya's Rift Valley region. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The day starts for the health officers in the nomadic region of Samburu, where most of the roads are impassable. But for the passion they have for the job, they walk several kilometers to meet the people and offer health services, mostly helping women to have safe child delivery, family planning, and vaccines for the children. Chief of Party for Afya Temeza Project for the USAID, Gilbert Wangalua, said that the Camel Clinic has improved health services in the region, in which most people used to succumb for lack of easy accessibility to health facilities.
Facilities are not easily accessible, so and therefore we have to basically to take the services where the communities are. And we have seen a significant increase in the women who are uptaking family planning services. So the Camel outreach has been able to unlock the geographical barrier.
During the services, the officers also educate the members of the public on the benefits of medical insurance. Mr. Wangalua says most of the people are not well informed health-wise in the region.
I would say that when you're looking at the financial protection, they are not able to access because of they are not aware of the available health finances packages. So when you are reaching with them, you are able to sensitize on them in terms of how they can be able to enroll on the National Health Insurance Fund.
Peter Nguya, a doctor with the Camel Clinic, narrates his ordeal with the journey. He says security in the area is not guaranteed and that while attending to patients, sometimes he encounters emergency cases that require specialists, which he says becomes a challenge. We have a lot of challenges in this journey, especially on matters security and a long distance that we walk to find people. We encounter different challenges with patients. Others have excess bleeding, especially women. The ones we can manage, we give them first aid. Samburu region has nomads and the Camel Mobile Clinic officers have to keep on moving with the community. Elizabeth Ngeyua, a health officer in the region, says the day-to-day activities are tiresome. We start our journey at 7 a.m. It depends with where we are headed to. We walk for 6 to 7 hours. Sometimes we walk the whole day. We just arrive and sleep. Then we work the following day, but we sacrifice and attend to the people. Universal healthcare is one of the Kenya's government big four agenda, and challenges such as lack of good infrastructure in remote areas seems to be a hindrance in achieving the agenda. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The UN Humanitarian Agency says two of Sudan's southeastern provinces have reported 124 suspected cholera cases with 7 deaths. The agency says states that have the highest risks of cholera outbreak are Sennar and Blue Nile following flash floods that swept the country in late August and affected water sanitation. Mary Keller is head of monitoring and reporting for the UN Humanitarian Agency in Sudan.
Well, so we only have confirmed numbers until the 19th of September. We have 124 cases in Blue Nile and Sennar states. Of course, that number is changing constantly, and we publish new information about the numbers as it becomes available from the Federal Ministry of Health.
Are there any reported deaths?
Yes. Unfortunately, we have 7 deaths that have been attributed to suspected cholera.
What might be the cause of the surge in cholera cases in Sudan?
Well, in Sudan, we've recently had a flooding event, a very widespread flooding event. And so I think we are seeing a surge of cases related to that flooding.
And what is the UN Humanitarian Agency doing with other organizations to avert the situation currently in Sudan?
Yeah, so, well, the first thing that the humanitarian system is trying to do is to really support and work with the government of Sudan, in particular the Federal Ministry of Health. In terms of specific support, we're really looking at strengthening the disease surveillance, so working with both federal and state ministries of health to identify new cases, to provide medical treatment for those cases, including oral rehydration, to distribute laboratory supplies also related to the treatment of cases, and then very importantly, to monitor the water quality and to chlorinate public water supplies to prevent the further spread. Another big aspect of what the humanitarian community is working with the government on is also promoting education amongst the at-risk communities.
Mary Keller is head of monitoring and reporting for the UN Humanitarian Agency in Sudan. She was speaking from Khartoum with reporter Mavis Ocheri. That's it for this Tuesday, September 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
The Voice of- of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, world leaders gather in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, plus growing Africa's agriculture. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.